So this week we are treated to the Parsha B'chukosai by itself. Commonly it goes together with Parshas Bahar, but in a leap year and sometimes in other years, Parshas B'chukosai. I would say it's a Parsha that I know quite well, or I've heard many times more correctly, of the three sons of ours who have been bar mitzvah. Two of them have been Parshas B'chukosai. So we've heard quite a few renditions and rehearsals. In fact, our next bar mitzvah, Mitzvah Hashem, is in 6.5 years. It will be in the middle of the summer. But we're strongly considering doing Parshas B'chukosai anyway, just for the Masorah. Either way. So B'chukosai is dominated, of course, by the brachos and then the klalos known as the tochacha, the rebuke. But let's begin at the beginning, and we'll begin with the positive. Im b'chukosai teilechu. That's how b'chukosai begins. If you go with my statutes, ve'es mitzvosai tishmeru, and fulfill my mitzvos, ve'asisam osam, and perform them. Guard my mitzvos and perform them. From that will come all the brachos, all of the blessings, gishmechem be'itam, etc. And without a doubt, one of the most famous comments of Rashi, certainly in our Parsha, and perhaps in all of Chumash VaYikra, is the first Rashi on B'chukosai. At the face of it, it seems very easy to translate, simple and straightforward. B'chukosai teilechu. Chukim are a type of mitzvah, perhaps referring to mitzvahs even generally, and therefore B'chukosai teilechu refers to keeping the mitzvahs. However, as we know, it's not so simple. And Rashi walks us through the process which will lead us to a somewhat different conclusion. Im b'chukosai teilechu. If you all go with my statutes, yachol, I might have thought, when we start yachol, like yachol mirosh chodesh, I might have thought, ze kiyum ha-mitzvahs. I might have thought this refers to the fulfillment of the mitzvahs. That's what it sounds like. What's the problem? Because kishuhu omer ve'es mitzvosai tishmeru, because the pasuk goes on to talk about fulfillment of mitzvos in the very next phrase. And having seen that, hari kiyum ha-mitzvos amor. So the fulfillment of mitzvos is already covered by the second phrase. So having seen that, we go back to the first phrase. Hama ani mekayem im b'chukosai teilechu. How then do I understand the first phrase, B'chukosai teilechu, shetihiyu amelim b'Torah, that you shall be toiling in Torah? And therefore, according to Rashi, just in brief, if the pasuk had only referred to B'chukosai teilechu, we would have assumed that refers to keeping mitzvahs. But if it goes on to talk about mitzvosai tishmeru, so then, reflectively, we go back and understand it somewhat differently, the concept of amelim b'Torah, toiling in Torah. So all of the brachas begin with this concept called amelim b'Torah, toil, amal. And it's worthwhile asking a simple question, because as we will see, it will yield for us, I believe, a very meaningful answer. Namely, amal b'Torah, toiling in Torah, seems to denote a high-level involvement in learning, as if to say not just quote-unquote learning, but investing and toiling and working, the whole different type of relationship. And we're entitled to ask, with all due respect to this clearly high level of learning, why should the brachos, the blessings of our parsha, be contingent specifically on such a high level? As if to say, and again, kol hakavod to anyone who reaches that level. But what if a person is not toiling in Torah? He's just learning Torah. Learning Torah, last we checked, is also a good thing. Can also lead to good things. And that, therefore, is the question, why are the brachas dependent upon what we could call a mahadrin level of learning Torah, and not just the simple and straightforward level? And a very, I believe, important answer. I heard this a number of years back. There was a guest speaker on our shul. I don't know much about him, but his answer resonated with me. Blessings are a double-edged sword. Because, especially the type of blessings that our parsha is referring to. Because they all are referring to material prosperity, financial prosperity. And now the question is material prosperity a good thing? And the answer is it depends. It depends on the person. Especially if the end goal is to live a good Jewish life and to be as best as one can and to do as best as one can. Sometimes material prosperity signals the end of all of that. There are many people that they're doing okay materially, financially, and they're doing very well Jewishly. You'll see them in shul, you'll see them in shiurim, they're involved in communal affairs, and they're doing mitzvos, etc. If they should strike gold and business should start to boom, you may never see them again. Not in shul, not in the shir. They're in the office, locked away, sequestered forevermore. Which means, for some people, for their blessings to come true could be their undoing. Because they've done mitzvahs in reward for which they've received prosperity, as a result of which they don't do mitzvahs anymore. That's not a good outcome, but it can certainly happen. So really the question is, with whom can material prosperity be vouchsafed? With whom is it safe that it will lead to only positive Jewish and spiritual outcomes if they should be showered with these material blessings? And the answer to that is Amelim Batorah. The concept of Amal reflects, we translate it as toil, which is a very archaic sounding word, but what it reflects is investment, commitment, effort. It tends to be true in life that the things that we invest effort in, we become connected to. The things that we work at, we stay with, and they stay with us. Things that are easy come or easy go, but things that are harder come by stay with us. And that's why the Torah says HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to give us blessings, but not if the blessings will lead to an abdication or even a diminution of our Jewish standards and of our spiritual standards. And that is why the Torah says, if you are Amelim BaTorah, if you're toiling in Torah, so then you will be connected with Torah, and then blessings can be entrusted to you, that they will not lead to the derailing of your Jewish living. So that is a very interesting and thought-provoking observation on the very well-known first Rashi in Bechukosai, why Amelim BaTorah is such a significant thing. To talk more generally about the opening of our parsha, we do note, as Mefarshim have discussed even from the time of Rishonim, that the blessings that the Torah promises are physical in nature, not spiritual. That is probably one of the more famous questions that accompanies the beginning of Bechukosai. Why does it say that if you fulfill the mitzvahs, you receive rains in their time? Why not say if you fulfill the mitzvahs, you'll have a share in the world to come? Which is what we would consider the more traditional Jewish answer. Many, many Mefarshim, again from Rishonim, Ibn Ezra, Chovos Havavos, and Rambam, and many others discuss that. But what's also of great interest is that even within the sphere that the blessings occur, that is to say, in the physical sphere, they are not only physical blessings, they're natural blessings. As if to say, even within physical experience, there can be two types of blessing. There can be a successful natural living, and there can be supernatural occurrences. They exist in this world, but they are miraculous in nature. And the Torah does not promise miracles. What the Torah promises is, as the Psukim go on to detail, Gishmechem bi'itam, rains in the time, a good harvest, very successful living, but within the bounds of nature. And this is something which the Meshech Chochma discusses at length. And it really is a major comment on the entire institution that we call nature. As if to say that the correct way to relate to the natural world is to understand that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has pre-programmed into the world, into the rules of nature, the capacity to provide for everyone, and moreover, that it should depend on people's performance, on their spiritual standards. In other words, the natural world contains within it a range of responses depending on how the Jewish people are doing. And that's what we find in the beginning of the Parsha. For example, rainfall. The rains can fall on many different occasions in many different ways, but the promise is that they'll fall bi'itam, in times that are good. As Rashi explains, that means that the rains will fall on the Erev Shabbos, times when people are at home, in any case, in no way inconvenience. It's a way of extracting from nature the optimum result, that it should come, not only the rain should come, but they should come at a good time. In fact, it's worthwhile mentioning, parenthetically, a fascinating comment of the Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who, in addition to writing his notes and comments on the Shulchan Aruch, also has a sefer called Toras HaOla, which is all about Korbanos and the Beis HaMikdash, but as we can appreciate, will branch out into other things at any time, digressions and excursions and so on. And he discusses the question that Rashi mentions in Parshas Noach, namely, that there were certain generations of righteous people, and the hallmark or the trademark of their righteousness, the signature, was that a rainbow was never seen in their time. Examples of such people are Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, just to be yotzei a dover be'ito, coming up to Lag Ba'omer, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, a rainbow was not seen in his time, Chizkiyahu, and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, so on and so forth. And Rishonim grapple with the question, what does it mean for a rainbow not to be seen? After all, as far as we can understand, a rainbow is a result of the rays of the sun refracting off the moisture in the air after rainfall. That seems to be a relatively natural occurrence. So as much as the rainbow seems to be a somewhat a brusque reminder that perhaps things are not in order, but what are we to make of the notion that a rainbow wouldn't be seen? Are we to understand that the laws of physics have been suspended for these righteous individuals? And some people say yes. And, of course, anything is possible. But the Ramah in the Sefer Toras HaOla says a wonderful and elegant explanation of this matter. Namely, when we say that there were certain individuals that a rainbow was never seen in their time, it's very simply because Rashi tells us from Chazal that if the Jewish people are as they should, the rain only comes at night, and specifically on Friday night when people are already home. If it only rains at night, you will never see a rainbow, because the time after the rainfall is the middle of the night. It's just there is no sunlight there. And this, therefore, is his very wonderful explanation of that phenomenon of a rainbow not being seen. No rainbows are ever seen at night. The point is the rain came at night. And that's because of Yimbuchu Kosei Teilechu. But the point is, we need to understand that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has instilled and programmed within the natural world the capacity to cater for all levels of response depending on the level of spiritual living and religious observance. What then is the role of miracles? Miracles, says Meshech Chochma, are there just because it's easy to get used to the natural order and forget that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is guiding the world. So once in a while, you have a supernatural occurrence which just serves as a reminder that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is yet supervising things and running things. But if the goal is to remind you of that, and once you are alerted and are reminded, it can then revert to the natural order. And that is the ideal. And that's very interesting. And in fact, even in the words of Chazal, we find different opinions as to whether a natural existence is ideal or miraculous existence is ideal. For some people, the more miracles, the better. Whereas for others, no. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has set up the world for a reason, and it contains his wisdom, and it contains a program that can basically sustain the entire world. That is the ideal. And with this in mind, Meshech Chochmah draws our attention to two, I would say, similar statements with conflicting outcomes. The Gemara in one place, that is in Maseches Brachos on Daf Dalet, states regarding Ashrei. Whoever says Ashrei three times every day, or actually whoever says Ashrei every day or three times every day, that person is a Ben Olam Haba. The greatest thing you can do is say Ashrei every day. Ben Olam Haba. Okay. It's very interesting to contrast this with a statement in Maseches Shabbos, in Daf Kuf Yud Ches, which says, Kol ha'omer halal ha'godol b'chol yom. What if you would say halal ha'godol? What is halal ha'godol? So we're familiar, of course, with the halal that we say on Yom Tov and Rosh Chodesh, etc. Halal ha'godol is the chapter of Tehillim 136, which has those 26 psukim which end ki le'olam chasto. All of those ki le'olam chastos, which we add on Psukei Dezimra on Shabbos morning, that is called halal ha'godol. And the Gemara says, what if you would say halal ha'godol every day? How would that sound? And the answer, says the Gemara, hareze mecharef umigadef. That person is insulting and blaspheming to say halal ha'godol every day. And that is a statement to be reckoned with. After all, I think there's certainly worse things a person could do every day than say halal ha'godol. And especially when we remember that if you say Ashrei every day, it's outstanding. And one could only imagine if you say all the Kila Olam Chasters every day, it would be noch more outstanding. And lo and behold, it's considered a terrible thing. But why? What can be so wrong with saying the one every day, and what's so right about saying the other every day? And Meshech Chochmah says it is exactly this point. Sometimes people feel that they are saying something wonderful, they don't realize the implications of what they're saying. Halal HaGodol deals with many miraculous events. Kriyas Yamsuf, Lugozer Yamsuf Ligzarim, Kilo Olam Chasto, Makas Bechoros, Lamake Mitzrayim Bivchareihem. These are things that certainly need to be remembered, mentioned, and appreciated. But if this becomes your daily praise, there's a dangerous implication. And that is, Hashem is to be praised for out-of-the-world things like that. For miracles, then I'll turn to Hashem and say, thank you. Thank you for providing that miracle. The implication is that anything which falls short of the miraculous, I don't appreciate, and perhaps don't even recognize. Maybe the only things I recognize as coming from Hashem are miracles. But as far as the natural world is concerned, it was put on set, automatic, and that's that. And now you can understand, says Meshech Chochmah, why a person who would say that every day, it's the equivalent almost of blasphemy. And all he wants to do is say Halal HaGadol. But he doesn't realize that the tone-deaf element here is that what he's saying is for miracles, you thank Hashem, and for nature, you thank either no one, or you thank nature, or you thank yourself. And that's what's so problematic about saying Halal HaGadol every day. In contrast with this is Ashrei. And the Gemara itself discusses what's so great about Ashrei. And one of the things it mentions is that Ashrei follows the order of the Aleph Beis. And starting from Aramimcha and then B'chol Yom Avarchecha, as we know, with the exception of the letter Nun, which the Gemara discusses, but it follows the Seder of Aleph Beis. The meaning of a chapter following the order of the Aleph Beis, it's not just for convenience or to be neat, but it represents a progression from stage to stage in the same way that the Aleph Beis are the basic elements of the Hebrew language, and you go from Aleph to Beis to Gimel. So things that are described using the Aleph Beis, using the Seder of the Aleph Beis, are progressions one stage to another. And that is a statement about the natural world. When you praise Hashem every day using the Aleph Beis, you're praising Him for these, for the cycles and the stages and the cause and effect, how A leads to B and B leads to C, or how Aleph leads to Beis and Beis leads to Gimel. And what's interesting is, as Meshech Chochma points out, there's another place in the davening every day where we make a point of following the Aleph Beis. And that is in the first bracha before Shema, the bracha of Yotze Or. During the week, there's a section that follows the Aleph Beis, and also on Shabbos. During the week, Kel Baruch Gadol De'ah, right? Just one word each, and you get from Aleph all the way through the Aleph Beis. On Shabbos, we expand it a little more. Kel Adon, Al Kol HaMa'asim, Baruch HaMavarech, Rafikon Neshama, etc. Why do we follow the Aleph Beis each day in its own way in that blessing? Because that is the blessing of the natural world. That's the blessing of Yotze HaMa'oros, of light, Yotze Or Uvarei Choshech. It's about Mechadish Betuvo B'chol Yom Ma'aseh Bereishis. It's about the natural world, and therefore the taking our cue from Ashrei, almost, the correct way and the optimum way to praise Hashem there is through the Aleph Beis. This is in contrast with the second blessing, which is as we go from the natural world more to the unique spiritual destiny of the Jewish people. The giving of the Torah, the choosing of Bnei Yisrael, so on and so forth. That's really the progression of the first blessing to the second, Yotze Or, to Ahava Rabbah. But in Yotze Or, it is appropriate to praise Hashem using the Aleph Beis. And in the conclusion, says Meshech Chochma, and again, it's such a simple observation that began the whole discussion, but to appreciate how the sum of the blessings within the physical world that the Torah promises are optimum and maximum natural blessing, because that is the world, the way Hashem has set it up, responding maximally to Jewish people's maximal spiritual input, yielding maximal physical output. So we've discussed the nature, pardon me, of the blessings, and we do need to move, I would say, to the tochacha, especially as depending on what shul you're in, sometimes if you hesitate or are distracted for a moment, the tochacha is over. It's read sometimes at breakneck speed. But either way, one of the verses is Pasuk Yud Tes. Perek Kaf Vav Pasuk Yud Tes. And the Pasuk states, among the curses, V'shavarti Esgaon Uzchem. And I will break the pride of your strength, which sounds terrible, and it is. But what does it mean? To what does it refer? What is Gaon Uzchem, the pride of your strength? Rashi comments, and Rashi's comment is from the Taras Kohanim. And Rashi says very simply, what is Gaon Uzchem, the pride of your strength? Ze Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash is the pride of the strength of the Jewish people. And he quotes a pasuk from Yechezkel, which states this explicitly. V'chein hu omer, as the pasuk says, hinini mechalel es mikdashi, es Gaon Uzchem. Hashem says, I will profane my sanctuary, the pride of your strength. That is the Beis HaMikdash. So that is a lock. I mean, that is the Pasuk itself states that the Mikdash is Gaon Uzchem, the very same expression in our Pasuk. And that's Rashi, and that we could say is the straightforward understanding of the Pasuk. Rashi's source, as we mentioned, is the Taras Kohanim. And if you consult the Taras Kohanim, you'll find that this is not the only interpretation advanced in explanation of the words Gaon Uzchem. It's the explanation of the Chachamim, of the sages. But the Taras Kohanim says, Rabbi Akiva, he explained that Gaon Uzchem refers to a person. To who? Yoav ben Tseruya, the pride of the Jewish people's strength. Yoav ben Tseruya. And as we can appreciate, many Mefarshim are wondering how Rabbi Akiva can consider that individual, who clearly was a great person once upon a time, and it was a tragedy if he was that he met his downfall in the way that he did. But how does this become Rabbi Akiva's rendition and understanding of the expression "Vishavati Geonuschem"? He seems to have reached into history, extracted a very specific individual, and hard for us to see how that really reflects the quintessential fulfillment of this curse. But that is why Reuven Margolius, in one of his Sfarim, I believe HaMikra V'HaMesora, or maybe Lecheker Shemus V'Kinuyim, the Talmud, many works he wrote, he says something else. He suggests that when Rabbi Akiva is lamenting the demise and the downfall and defeat of Yoav ben Tseruya, that great general in Israel, he actually has someone else in mind. Let's talk for a minute about Yoav ben Tseruya. What could we say as a sketch, in brief? Well, originally he was a tzaddik, a rising star, ally of David HaMelech, and yet, over the course of time, something happened to him, at the risk of oversimplifying, but he soured somewhat and became jealous to the extent that he even murdered Amasa ben Yeser, who was a great tzaddik, and that began a downward spiral for him. And in the end, he met an ignoble demise. And that's a tragedy which happened in its time called Yoav ben Tseruya. There is someone much closer to Rabbi Akiva's time whose life followed a very similar pattern, and that is Shimon ben Kochba. Shimon ben Kochba, who began to spearhead the revolt against Rome a number of decades after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, initially very successful, and Rabbi Akiva saw in him great potential. He considered that this could be the Mashiach. He was the one that called him Bar Kochba. He adduced, I think his name was originally Bar Kusiva, and he became called Bar Kochba because Rabbi Akiva adduced regarding him the pasuk Darach Kochav Miyakov, a star has shot out from Yaakov, and he became then known as Bar Kochba. And the revolt, as we said, was very successful, with the full support of Rabbi Akiva. But something happened. And what happened to Bar Kochba was very similar to what happened to Yoav ben Tseruya all those generations ago. He began to falter, began to get paranoid, and it didn't stop until he murdered his own uncle. It's terrible to talk about it, but Rabbi Elazar HaModa'i, he believed false reports about him and he killed him. And this was the beginning of the end, again, of Bar Kochba. So, it's interesting, we never really hear Rabbi Akiva talk about Bar Kochba past the point where he had those hopes for him. And the reason is very simple, says Reuven Margolius. Once Bar Kochba was killed when the revolt was crushed, to hold a public eulogy for a member who spearheaded a rebellion is itself an act of rebellion. There is no way that they could publicly eulogize Bar Kochba. But it still happened. He just didn't call him Bar Kochba. Rabbi Akiva, he gathers everyone together and laments the death of Yoav ben Tseruya. Not a word was said about Rabbi Shimon Bar Kochba, and there was no one there, Jewish, who didn't realize exactly who Rabbi Akiva was talking about. And this, therefore, was the, as far as Reuven Margolius explains the Toras Kohanim, very, very compelling. Rabbi Akiva's eulogy for Bar Kochba was lamenting in this pasuk the demise of Yoav ben Tseruya. Very interesting. What's also, again, a parenthetical comment, but quite fascinating. We hear quite a lot about Rabbi Akiva's thoughts concerning Bar Kochba. the hopes he had for him, the way that he thought he was, and he supported him, etc. Do we ever get to find out what Bar Kokhba thought about Rabbi Akiva? I don't know if he ever spoke about it. But it turns out that we do. Interestingly, in the parsha of a couple of weeks ago, Parshas Emor, so we have the Arba Minim, the four Minim on Sukkos. And how much are there of each? Everyone knows. One Lulav, one Esrog, three Hadassim, and two Aravos. That's the halacha. I've never seen anyone do any different. But that is not the only opinion in the Mishnah. If you look in the Mishnah in Sukkah, so you will find that opinion. And again, that's the halacha. But it also records Rabbi Akiva's opinion. According to Rabbi Akiva, on Sukkos, you take one of each species. One Lulav, one Esrog, one Hadas, and one Arava. And again, we don't paskin that way. Did anyone paskin that way? Well, as we mentioned a few moments ago, the revolt of Bar Kokhba in the first couple of years was extremely successful. So much so, they captured strongholds and they really had the Roman occupation in many places on the retreat. In those days, to a degree still now, but certainly in those days, any significant event, a victory, a success, or whatever it would be, became minted as a coin. That would preserve it for posterity and publicize it at the time. Its money would change hands. The famous Judea captor is a coin when everything was crushed. But the rebellion was so successful in those early years that actually Bar Kokhba's army minted coins of victory. And we still have some of those coins. And what's on them? What's heads and what's tails? On the one side, you have a Jewish warrior. And what's on the other side? Arba Minim. The four species of Sukkot. Amazing to have such a mitzvah as the other side of the coin. Well, how many minim are there? One Esrog, one Lulav, one Hadas, and one Arava. That is what the Arba Minim looked like as far as Bar Kokhba is concerned. And we will say, well, that's not the halacha. But if you're Bar Kokhba, of course it's the halacha. Because that's the opinion of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was clearly, as much as he supported them and he thought that they were doing a great thing, there is no doubt that they looked to him as their Rav, as their posek, as their spiritual guide. Which means whatever the Chachamim feel, if Rabbi Akiva says it's one of each, it's one of each, as we can see from the coin. So it's very interesting. When they say that money speaks, as far as Torah is concerned, it surely does. It tells us quite a lot about the reciprocal and the mutual relationship between Rabbi Akiva and Bar Kokhba. But in any case, to get back to Rabbi Reuven Margolius, really a stunning explanation of that Toras Kohanim that Rabbi Akiva is lamenting in Yoav ben Tzeruya, the demise of Bar Kokhba. If we can move back from here to the beginning of the Tochacha, it's interesting to consider what is the very first curse, and that is to be found in Pasuk Tet Zayin, which states, so it begins, the reversal begins in Pasuk Yud Dalet in Tesvav, if you don't keep the mitzvahs, and if you don't, everything from our part reversing. So Pasuk Tet Zayin says, Afani es ezos lachem. I will likewise do for you, v'ifkadeti alechem, and I will command over you, behala. And we'll come back to the word behala. And it goes on to Shechefes and Kadachas, which are all these terrible ailments, etc. And that's just the beginning. But the first word is Behala. And what does Behala mean? And why does it initiate all of the curses? So the word Behala, we normally translate as, let's say, to be startled. Mavhil. But part of what goes with being startled is a person who doesn't really have enough time to react to things properly. To be hurried or to be harried. And that we find, for example, in Megillas Esther. Vayavhilu la'avias Haman. They hurried Haman. He couldn't keep up with things because things were moving so fast. And the concept of behala means someone who is not able to give things the attention that they deserve because things are moving too fast. And what does that mean? One of the great rabbis in America, in a couple of generations back, his name was Reb Shmuel David Volkin. And his father was the Reb Aaron Volkin, the Rav of Pinsk. His son, actually, Reb Chaim Volkin, Shibodeh L'Chaim, was my Rebbe in Yeshiva. And this was a Mir family. In fact, Mir, I mean to say, the Yeshiva's Mir. My Rebbe was actually born in Shanghai during those years. And Reb Volkin, Reb Shmuel David Volkin, is quoted as commenting that of all the curses of the Tochacha, the curse of Behala, of being hurried, not only persists, but actually is exacerbated over time. And the reason why is because as things begin to speed up, everything speeds up. Which means there are certain things where it's of great benefit that they're quicker. If travel is quicker, it presumably, it's better. It's better to make a transatlantic journey in a matter of hours, even though they may seem long, than as a matter of weeks or more by boat, and so on and so forth. However, the inevitable result is, or maybe not inevitable, but the typical result is, that everything moves quicker. And sometimes things move quicker than they should, which leaves us neither here nor there. Never fully able to engage in things and to connect with them to the extent that we should. And how does this all begin? Remember, the blessings begin in Bechukosai Teilechu. It all starts with that concept called Amelim BaTorah, toiling in Torah, which is a very lofty sounding concept. But what does it represent? Toil represents giving something the time, the care, the attention, the devotion that it deserves. And if it takes a while, then that's the time, that is time well spent, and that's what it needs for an enduring result, for a meaningful result. So the blessings all begin with toil in good things. And how do the curses begin? Im lo tishmu'uli, says Pasuk Yudalad, says Rashi, not ameilim batorah. So what does it mean if you're not toiling in Torah? It means not giving enough time to things that are important. And Haskada Kodesh Baruch Hu says these terrible words in Pasuk Tetzayin, af ani esezos lachem. If you're not prepared to give time to things that are important, so then the first curse is that you don't really have enough time for anything. And to live in Behala, it's a state. It's a state of mind, if not an actual state of being. Because being in a hurry, certainly in our times, is no longer even about having anywhere to go. It's just it's its own state. In the same way that being busy is no longer necessarily about having anything to do. It's a state, it's almost an existential state. But it stops a person ever fully connecting and engaging meaningfully with things that really deserve it. And that, says Reb Shmuel David Volkin, as time goes on and things get quicker. And I think it's fair to say that part of the reason why we suffer from this is because for so many other things, speed is the benchmark of success. For machines, speed is the benchmark of success. How fast something could be computed or whatever, processed. And sometimes people's de facto role models are machines, especially if the people that used to be their role models or should be their role models disappoint them or are incarcerated or worse. So we turn to what seems to define success, and we get confused when we're not succeeding in the way that our machines are. Rav Kook has a fascinating discussion regarding one of the most unusual stories in all of the Gemara. It concerns two people. It's based on the pasuk in Chukas, which talks about Es Vahev Besufa, that those somewhat mystifying sounding psukim deep into Parshas Chukos. Es Vahev Besufa. What does that even mean? So without getting too much into the details, the Gemara says, Es and Vahev were two people, and they were mitzaraim, lepers, whatever tzaraas is, but for our purposes, lepers, which meant that they were thrown out of the Anane HaKavod. They would be trailing behind the clouds of glory, because you couldn't be within the Anane HaKavod if you had tzaraas. So you have these two unfortunate people with very unusual names, Es and Vahev, names that have not really caught on, not surprisingly. And however, they did witness something that no one else saw. As the Jewish people were about to enter the land of Israel, so the Emori, or some of the Emori, wanted to lay an ambush for them. They put themselves in caves. There was a certain valley that they were going to pass through, caves on either side, ready to attack them. However, unbeknownst to the Emori, was that the Aron that would go before the Jewish people leveled the ground before their travel, which means that everyone who was in those caves, the whole thing came together, it all closed up. All of the would-be attackers of the Jewish people looking to murder them themselves became crushed. And that's what happened. And the Jewish people passed by actually oblivious, because they're all literally in the clouds. They are within the Anane HaKavod. They have no notion that any from what they were spared. And no, they would never have known, except you had these two people who were outside the clouds, trailing behind. And as the Jewish camp moves on and things begin to open up and they see the remnants and the results of what would have been a catastrophe for the Jewish people had the Emori attacked them, they then came and informed Bnei Yisrael, you need to know that you have just been the beneficiaries of a major miracle. You never would have known. And we were told by these two mitzaraim. It's a very unusual situation. And of course, there's a lot to speak about, but Rav Kook has an explanation of this episode, which is just out of this world. Because he sees within this story, as the Jewish people are finally approaching the land of Israel, a kind of ma'ase avos, shall we say, a pre-experience for when the Jewish people will ultimately come back to the land of Israel. What's it going to look like? What type of people will be there? And what will successful people look like? And what will, shall we say, dysfunctional people look like? Because a metzora, his physical symptoms of tzaraas, is because there's something about his relationship with the world which is not right. And it's dysfunctional enough to express itself in tzaraas. And specifically, says Rav Kook, as the Jewish people prepare to re-enter the land of Israel, which are times that we are, Baruch Hashem, living in, who are the mitzaraim? One of them is called Es, and one of them is called Vahev. What is the meaning of those names, Es and Vahev? Says Rav Kook, these represent the wrong approach to the two most important areas in life, acquisition of wisdom and acquisition of meaningful relationships. And Es and Vahev are a corruption or a falling short in both of those areas. The word for truth in Hebrew is emes. And what's so important about that word? It starts with Aleph, back to our Aleph base. It starts with Aleph, and it ends with Taf. It has a direction, a beginning and an end, but it has a middle also. And the middle states that it's a process. As the Gemara says, Mem denotes Ma'amar, discourse, discussion. to try and understand something, to grapple with something. And the Gemara also states that there's two types of mem. Some mems are open and some are closed, because some ideas are easily accessible and some of them really need to be worked out more. They need to be cracked open. It's a process. But if you go the process, the result is MS. Who then is S? S, says Rav Kook, is a person who is not prepared to invest anything in this acquisition of wisdom. What is S? It's MS with nothing in the middle, nothing in between the Aleph and the Taf. As soon as he starts, he wants to finish. There is no journey. There is no process. And he ends up with nothing. He ends up with half understood or half digested and half remembered quasi-facts. And for him, that's his knowledge. He didn't put anything in. That's what he gets out. That's S. What about Vahev? Says Rav Kook, in the world of relationships, the word for love in Hebrew, as we know, is ahava. And what is the meaning of that word? It starts with an aleph and ends with a hey. That is to say, it starts perhaps small and it can grow. It's something that grows and develops. But what allows for it to grow and develop in a meaningful way? What's in the middle? What stands between the aleph in the beginning and the hey at the end? The answer is two letters, hey and beis, hav, and hav means to give. Havu, render, to give. A person who's prepared to invest and to give is someone who can see the aleph increase fivefold, and that is called ahava. That is a meaningful relationship as the product of investment and commitment and giving and so on and so forth. So who is Vahev? What has happened to Vahev, the second of our Mitzrayim? When you think about it, where did the Vav come from? There's no Vav in Ahava. Unless he sees the Aleph at the beginning, which is not so impressive. He sees the Hey at the end, which is more impressive. And he puts them together and he wants them all immediately. So when you put the Aleph and the Hey together, you get your Vav. And he wants six measures of love. Now, what about giving? That gets pushed aside to the end, if things even last that long. So, Vahev is Ava, which has the result brought forward to the beginning and the process pushed aside. And these people are outside of the camp because they'll never really get anywhere or gain anything, and they'll never understand why. And their job is to come and tell the Jewish people who have been following the Aron faithfully. And part of following the Aron means that they are prepared to invest in things that are important. And they need to be told by these two Mitzrayim just how much they've been spared from by following the Aron. Not that their lives are problem-free, but at least to have core values, that it's understood that these things take time. Things that are important deserve time. That is the job of the Mitzrayim, to come and tell those inside the Anane HaKavod. And it's interesting, if we go back to B'chukosai Teleichu, and Rashi, we remind ourselves, says, what does B'chukosai Teleichu mean? Does it refer to keeping the mitzvahs? That's mentioned in the second phrase in the pasuk. So what's the first phrase now, going back? Ameilim Bator. And what's interesting is, Rashi has demonstrated to us what the first phrase can't refer to. It can't be mitzvahs, because that's in the second phrase. But what we need to understand is, but how does it then come to mean Ameilim Batorah? One of the classic commentaries on Rashi's Perush, Rav Yisachar Ber Eilenberg in his Sefer Tzedah LaDerech, explains that the key word here is Teilechu, to go. It's an unusual way to refer to mitzvahs. Normally, we refer to mitzvahs as, even in our opening verse itself, Shmiras HaMitzvos, Kiyum HaMitzvos, Asiyas HaMitzvos, doing mitzvahs, fulfilling mitzvahs, etc. B'chukosai Teleichu, to go with mitzvahs. But what does that mean? We now come back to consider this phrase, telechu. Telechu denotes a journey. It denotes a process, and that process is called toiling in Torah, learning in Torah. In other words, with every mitzvah, it's defined. There is the action, and it's fulfilled, and that's a gain. When it comes to Torah learning, it takes the form of learning sessions, but it's all part of a broader journey, and it's a lifelong journey, and that's called b'chukosai teilechu. When will you toil in Torah if you understand that it is a process and it doesn't happen overnight? It's a trip, and it takes time, and as many stations and destinations. Teilechu is the most apt description of toiling in Torah, because you are constantly moving forward, and the things that you understood initially can be re-understood on a deeper level as we go through life and experience more. There's a fascinating comment of the I think we've had 6 fascinatings already this evening, but it's not my fault. It happens to be true. Rabbi Shlomo Ishtaruk, one of the great Sfardi Gadolim of the Rishonim, so he discusses the well-known statement, Shivim Panim La Torah, there are 70 faces to Torah. And what does that mean? And he explains, Shivim Panim La Torah is because the lifespan as described in Tehillim is 70 years. In other words, it's not so much that you sit down and you arrive at 70 understandings of something, but rather you have a certain understanding of a mitzvah or of an episode in the Torah or of a principle in the Torah. But that's this year. But then so much has happened between this year and next year. You come back to it. And when you do, you see another face to it, because what you've experienced and hopefully developed and matured, etc. So then that allows you to view it from a slightly different vista and reveal another layer of understanding. That's where the concept of Shivim Panim La Torah comes from, which is the opposite of a quick learning session. It's literally a lifelong accompaniment. And I believe it's fair to say, just in conclusion, we didn't really speak so much about the Omer, not at length. But the Omer is counting the Omer, a little bit enigmatic. Actually, probably more correct to say unnerving. Because you're told to count from 1 to 49 over the course of 7 weeks, which is so easy, it's almost distressing. You stand up every night and you say, tonight is such and such, and a part of you just doesn't know what to do next. Or someone should say something, because all you did was you said, tonight is 23 days in the Omer, and that's it. And I think it's also probably true, or possibly true, and I don't mean this in any negative way at all, but I think it could be that it's for this reason that we add so many things before and after the counting of the Omer. And again, kulam ahuvim, kulam berurim, all of them are good things. There's many worse things you could say than hinini muchan mezum and lakayim sfiras haomer. But it is very interesting that Sfiras HaOmer has a preparatory paragraph. I'm preparing myself to do a mitzvah, and it's in the Siddur, etc. And people say it. But every mitzvah has a preparatory paragraph, and people don't always say those. There's the L'Shem Yichud, Kudshe Berichu, which people say. Every mitzvah has L'Shem Yichud beforehand. And there are Kabbalah ideas that are also in the Siddur, where in the spheres and which sphere within which spheres. Every mitzvah has Kabbalah. And then there's a follow-up prayer, and every mitzvah has a follow-up prayer. But somehow we don't always say all of the before and afters for the other mitzvahs, even though they exist in equal measure. But when it comes to Sfiras HaOmer, we do. And perhaps the reason why is because we just need to keep the Omer count company. Because otherwise it's just a very lonely sentence which says, today is such and such in the Omer, and it's out there, and we don't know what to do next. And of course, the moral of the story is not that if your custom is to say those things, that there's anything in any way problematic with saying them. It's all fantastic. But the core of the count is the count. That it will never be replaced by anything else. And what is happening in the count? I think what's happening in the count is very simple. At least one emanation. Sfiras HaOmer is an interesting mitzvah, because it's a mitzvah which, by definition, you engage in knowing that you will not finish it all in one day. It's an amazing thing. I think it's rare to have a mitzvah like that. Most mitzvahs are a bit longer, a bit shorter, but it can be done in one day. Lo and behold, no one has ever tried to count the whole Omer in one day, nor considered themselves successful if they did so. It's not that hard to count to 49. But if you count the Omer from 1 to 49 in one setting, you've failed. Because it's understood from the outset, the mitzvah is, it's a process. You're not going to finish it in one day. But it's also true that you can't miss out the day. And that is the formula for a successful fulfillment of this mitzvah. It's such a simple thing. But it introduces a person to a mindset that will be critical for what is waiting at the other side of the Omer, namely the Torah. Because the last thing you want to, the worst mistake you want to make about receiving the Torah is that it can be all done in one day. And therefore, training, just as a way of relating to things, after 7 weeks, it's clear to us there are certain things in life, it won't happen in one day. But you can't miss a day. And now you're ready to receive the Torah. Why? Because it also won't be done in one day. But you don't want to miss a day. Because every day counts. And that, I think, is a very real and meaningful preparation way. It takes a few seconds to count the Omer. But you're able to begin to relate to things in that way. Because as Es and Vahiv taught us, things that are important deserve the time that we invest in them. That is the concept of Amelim Batorah, Teleichu, the concept of the journey. So these are things which are Mitzvah Hashem. The more we take the heart, the more we can hope for only for the brachos at the beginning of the parsha, less of the klalos and none of the klalos as we make our way towards our Sinai and beyond to Mitzvah Hashem. All the very best. Have a good night. Wonderful week.